Thank you. Hey, everybody. I'm Scarlett, alcoholic.
Hi.
Golly, thanks so much for having me up here. This is great. I love coming up here. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And I got to tell you, my sobriety date is August 25th, 2010. I have a sponsor that I keep current with and honest. I see her at least twice a week, so I consider myself fortunate for that. I have a home group, and I'm active in that home group, and it's the Buckingham Big Book Group, the Island of Buckingham. And you know what? I got that home group just by a pure, unadulterated character defect of mine, and it was the best place for me. I went there, just jumping into this a little bit, I went there because I didn't want to know anyone when I went to the meeting. And thought, I've got to go somewhere, but I've got to go somewhere where I don't know a soul. And I did that, and did know a soul, did know one soul. But, you know, it was the best, very best meeting just for me. It was perfect. And I saw my sponsor, and that hurt my sponsor that night. But the as important as that was that I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous that very night. And that was life-changing and life-saving. Because before that, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had no idea what was wrong with me. You know, I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous just kind of in a general and brief way because I grew up with alcoholics. And my mother is alcoholic and my stepdad was alcoholic. Having said that, it was in the 70s, and I don't know a thing about Alcoholics Anonymous in the 70s, but I do know that she went to some meetings for a while and some things changed, and she didn't keep going to meetings, and so some things got worse. But I was 7 years old, so I don't know. What I can tell you is that hearing the message that night, hearing exactly about, you know, the spiritual principles and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it finally, for the first time in my life, at 48 years old, made sense. Like something I knew for the first time ever, what in the heck was wrong with me? Because before that, I had no idea. I thought, you know, I had some kind of syndrome. I thought I had some kind of thing. I thought, I'm just a desperate housewife. I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. And I knew that there were things that had happened. There were things that I had done. I knew that, you know, like I needed to take a look at my drinking. I knew I had a drinking problem. Like that much I knew. But I also thought I had this, and this. And these things over here were just part of my makeup. And I would continue to look at my drinking. And that was in a nice little cubby. And it wasn't until you guys told me that this and this and that, it's alcoholism. And I didn't know. So I am just eternally grateful for that because it's, you know, I'm thinking, oh, the only thing wrong with me is that I've got some kind of weird syndrome or, you know, I just need to grow the heck up. I just need to be, you know, white wine lady who lunches. I just need to, you know, stop being random and impulsive. I just need to stop drinking until I fall down and break bones. I didn't know. My childhood is not, you know, I got to tell you, I'm like a lot of folks that we hear, and they always say they felt different and something was weird. You know, I will definitely tell you that was me. I always felt odd. I was an only child. My dad died before I was born. And I will also say that my mom continually, like, told me, like, you're so special because, you know, you almost weren't born and blah, 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 and all this. And that, instead of, like, that being a good thing, that was always, like, this weird thing. I was like, I'm so... It was always a weird thing to me just to have that kind of thing. And, you know, I always wondered, okay, about my dad and, you know, but he died when my mom was just 2 months pregnant. So, you know, I don't know. She married another man when I was 18 months old, and that was not so good. They drank together. I grew up in a lot of turbulence. I grew up in a very much alcoholic kind of bad place to be. I saw a lot of behavior that I didn't ever want to repeat. And I didn't. I didn't repeat a lot of that behavior until later in my life. Alcohol isn't a huge, you know, I can't tell you really my first drink. I think it was when I was a teenager. It wasn't any, it was nothing special. But I do remember drinking and thinking, ooh, this is something interesting. You know, but it wasn't really until much later, when I was probably in my 20s, that that switch got turned on. But the characteristics of alcoholism were always there. I never felt like I fit in. I never felt like I was okay. I always, and I was really good at being, you know, I could form fit, kind of morph into whatever I thought, you know, was good and would make me fit in at the time. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents growing up, and I think, you know, just like we talk about, it takes a village. I think that was true. I think that was true for me, because my grandparents really were sort of an anchor and sort of a stability factor in growing up. One of the things I can remember, my mom and I, we spent a lot of time running away from situations. And one of the things, we were driving back from Florida once, I was 7. You know, back then, drinking and driving wasn't like it is today. But my mother got pulled over on the interstate. And I remember this very clearly. She said, yeah, get out of the car, get out of the car. And the policeman came up and said, ma'am, can I help you? And she says, and she's mixing her vodka, you know, and she's like, oh, no. And I'm like, what? She said, I'm just changing the diapers on the baby. You know, I'm 7. And so, you know, that was the kind of stuff I grew up with, and vowed that I would never have that happen. Met my high school sweetheart, married my high school sweetheart. Everything was going just fine. Had some children. But, you know, even then, I wanted things the way I wanted them when I wanted them. So one of the things that, you know, I didn't think I was having kids in a timely manner. So I decided to go on some fertility pills. And, you know, I was very good at talking people into things. And so that's what I did. I talked this OBGYN into some fertility pills, and lo and behold, I had twins. I was pregnant with twins. You know, we'd only tried to have a family for about 3 months, but that was too, that was just, you know, I'm tired of this. We got to hurry up here. And the reason that's even significant is because what happened, I got sick when I was about 7 months along. And my twins were born 13 weeks early. And back in 1986, they were very ill, and I was very ill too. We lost one of the girls when she was 4 months old. And, you know, it wasn't until going through this process, you know, and a lot of times I could tell myself, well, that's just the way it happened, and this, that, and the other. But honestly, you know, it was a factor. It was one of my character defects. I wanted things the way I wanted it when I wanted it. You know, I'm always trying to get in there and do God's work. I'm always trying to get in there and, you know, manage my life. And that was, you know, evident from even back then. We did go on to have another child. My surviving child is fine. Thank gosh. But we did go on to have one more child. So I have 2 grown daughters today, and they are wonderful and the highlight of my life. I can also tell you that I have a granddaughter today, and that's also great. But none of that would have been possible 2 years ago. The thing that sticks out and just to me it jumps out is one of the things, and Doctor's Opinion talks about this, you know, my book is all marked up like a lot of ours are, but I love how he describes the different types of alcoholics and, you know, all these and many others, and I love that and many others because, you know, I certainly didn't think I was, you know, the manic depressive and the psychopath, you know, blah, 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 but it's all these and many others. I think, you know, it's awesome that this is in there because a many other covers many different things. I think there are a lot of women like myself that walk around and we don't know what the heck's wrong with us. We just think that there's something wrong with us, but we never take a look. I never want to connect the dots between my drinking and the chaos and the wreckage in my life. The doctor's opinion was really helpful with that. But I would tell you that I'm a nice person. I would have told you I'm a nice person. I would have told you that I had exactly what Bill Wilson talks about, which is a mere a code of moral and better philosophy. And that if I had such codes and philosophies, it didn't save me no matter how much I tried. That is all true. You know, he talks about on page 45, I was a nice person. However, nice people nice people still try to do, you know, outrageous things. I was drunk in church a lot. I was drunk a lot in general, but, you know, I did all these things. I did things that I thought would try to fix me. One of the things was that I thought, you know, I will become organic farming lady. And so that was one of the things that I did. And each time that I would, you know, take a suit down out of the closet, as it were, and try this on, you know, try this shtick on for size, you know, it would last a couple years. And then what would happen is that would get really old. I'd be drinking and drinking and drinking. But it's all fine because nothing has happened. Nothing's happened. Everything's going great. But all of a sudden, something inside, like this isn't working anymore, and I'm all of a sudden miserable for no real reason. No real reason. I'm looking to everybody else, but especially the one that's there the whole time and loves me the most, which is my husband. I'm looking to him because there's some kind of problem. It's got to be his fault. I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do this organic farming, you know, lady thing, and that got old. And so then I decided that, you know, we should sell that house and we would move and we would do, I don't know, you know, historic house owner people. And so we did that. And so I did geographics, and they're all about within a 5-mile radius of Scottsdale. And that is the truth. That is the truth. We bought and sold 7 homes in a period of 17 years. Never taking a look at my drinking, never caring to take a look at my drinking. It's just like Bill talks about in his story. You know, it's you can plot it out on a graph. And there was a point where, you know, I thought I had arrived. And that was when we bought the historic house. And we were in walking distance of everything in Scottsdale. And one of the places that I could go and get my drink on was a restaurant in Scottsdale. So we could go there, we could walk, we could crawl home, and it was awesome. It was awesome. My kids at that point were about 13 and 14 years old, and they're seeing all this, and they're seeing mom get drunk, and they're seeing mom start vomiting. They're seeing mom doing a lot of things and missing a lot of time from work. But everything we did, we didn't hang out with people that didn't drink. And the thing is, I was real crafty about making sure that I was under the radar. And so I would drink. I was kind of the baby of the group. So all my women friends drank worse than me. And I was able to maintain that for a long, long time. I got real tired of nursing. I'm a nurse. And I got tired of doing that. I thought, I just need a break. So I decided to buy a store. Because, you know, if I'm not going to do what I was trained to do, let me just do something I don't know how to do. So I bought a store, and that was great because I could drink on the job. Because we sold wine. And we decided to get a tasting license, and we would do this. And so I could drink on the job. I could drink morning and noon and night, and it was just fine. I did that for many, many years. Unfortunately, I didn't factor in a few other things along the way, like, you know, having partners that weren't exactly honest. Didn't factor in the economy, that kind of thing. We ended up losing a lot of money on something that I wanted to take a break on. I hid that from my husband. I didn't tell him that I'd gotten us in $40,000-some of debt. I was really good at doing the credit card shuffle. And I did that for about 10 years. And he didn't ask, and I didn't tell. And that's the truth. So everything is still looking really good on the outside. I'm still driving the appropriate foreign car. I'm still wearing the appropriate clothes. I'm still getting my children to the appropriate after-school classes. But I'm starting to feel the result of lying and cheating and starting to project some kind of weird thing that something inside is happening to me, but I'm going to make it about you. And so I didn't have anything nice to say about anybody. My women friends I would be nice to their face, but I would talk behind their back. My women friends, again, we all hung out together because we all did the same thing, and we would dress it up in book clubs, and we would dress up in Bunko, and we did all these things to look okay because, you know, I don't drink out of a paper bag, so I'm not an alcoholic. And that's what I thought. In 2007, I'd had a lot of, you know, experiences that would show me and tell me that I'm alcoholic. But I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to look at it. I'm certainly not going to do anything about it. But I started getting to the point where I'm back in nursing by this time, by the way. We'd sold the store at a huge loss, and so we have to take this huge, big, fat second mortgage on our home. And my husband didn't know about that, but he didn't know about the other $42,000 on credit cards. And by this time, I'm drinking all the time. My employee history was not good. I was able to take a real advantage of my employer because I could walk to work. And I'm real manipulative in that way. So I was able to convince him that, you know, he really didn't need me there at 8:30. He needed me there at 10 to 9, you know. I was able to manipulate the patient schedule sometimes so that I didn't have to have a patient at 8:30. I could have a patient at 9 o'clock. All that stuff is minute, and it doesn't sound like a big deal. But when you put it all together, at least from my experience, you know, it makes for a life that I wanted to eventually run away from, and I was going to do that in any way that I could. Oftentimes I had fantasies of just running away, and I couldn't articulate to you that I wanted to leave my kids or my husband. I couldn't tell you that, but I just had these great thoughts. I'm just going to leave. I just think I need a complete change. I just need a complete change. And I could see myself going to some island somewhere and living this life when the life I had was perfectly fine on the outside. All that's starting to add up, and it's just making me feel like the worst person in the world. You know, I'm starting to feel like when I look back on my childhood and I think my head is five sizes too big, you know, or, you know, my mom dressed me in dorky clothes. I mean, look back on those pictures and none of that was true. But I'm starting to feel like that as an adult. You know, I'm starting to just feel like, you know, I've got something, a tail and horns, you know. I was doing things that were bad. I was just doing bad things, things that don't make up a good life. It was about that time that I started checking my blood every day, or not every day, excuse me, every week. And I was able to do that because I could draw my own blood. So I was able to sneak that. And so I would do that, and I kept thinking, well, you know, I'm just going to do this, because I knew I was starting to have some physical consequences from my drinking. I was starting to get marks and bruises, and I was starting to have some facial things, and I kind of knew that. My skin was starting to do some funky things. I started vomiting a lot more, and I thought, you know, I really need to get a hold of this. So I started checking. So my answer is not to look at my drinking, but to look at my lab values. So I started drawing my own blood and sending my blood off to the lab every week. And I thought, well, as long as my liver function tests are fine, just keep drinking. And that's what I did. My liver function tests were fine, and so I just kept drinking. In 2007, I got really, really drunk one night. And, you know, it was never enough time. It was never enough to have one event. Whatever the event was, that was just a warm-up. And so we would go out, and the whole thing is, you know, we would go out and spend, you know, way too much money and do way too many stupid things. And then we'd go to, you know, X, Y, and Z, just like we all do, right? But again, wanting my way, I insisted that, you know, we go home, but I've got to go to the bathroom. I got to go to the bathroom really bad. I can't wait. She's got to stop. And so I made, you know, a car full of people. We stopped at the post office in Keene, and it was very dark. And I got out, and as soon as I got out, I hit the pavement, and I smacked down those parking blocks, those concrete parking block things, because I just got out. And I broke my cheekbone, I broke my kneecap. I broke my left foot. And the consequence of that was being laid up for, I don't know, 8 or 9 weeks. You know, I looked pretty bad. But the bigger consequence was I had to lie. I had to lie and tell everybody, yeah, I tripped. It might be the post office's fault. I don't know. They shouldn't have put that concrete block there. I tripped. You know, I never told anyone except the people that were in the car. They knew. But they were drinking too. They never told anybody I was drunk. I got drunk and I fell down. That, you know, that's not going to tell that. So I'm laid up for 8 weeks. And it wasn't good. And so that was when I knew I really need to start drinking more responsibly. So I started drinking to the point where I would not fall down. And that's what I did most of the time. When I started getting kicked out of restaurants in Charlottesville, I would be asked to leave restaurants. But it was always, you know, I was able to somehow whine my way into, well, but I just wanted to go to the bathroom. They wouldn't take me. And, well, ma'am, you can come back next week. You just can't stay here tonight. And so that was the way it always was, because I didn't want to look at my drinking. I didn't want to look at anything to do with my drinking. I'm starting to, you know, my kids are growing up. They're seeing their mom really just, they're seeing their mom just no holds bar. And what I told myself during that period of time was, I choose to drink this way. This is my right. I spent a lot of years raising my kids and doing the thing, and now this is my time. And that's what I told myself. And our book mentions, you know, a heavy drinker and the difference in alcoholism and heavy drinking. My husband is a heavy drinker. With sufficient reason, he quit. When I got sober, he quit. And the difference was, you know, he's fine. He's great. He doesn't need another solution because he doesn't have alcoholism. But I can tell you that he drank to keep up with me. And it's a bad thing to do that to someone, because he got to the point where he had to drink to keep up with me. He was having some consequences physically from his drinking. And yet I can see, and I have an upfront and real in my face example of the contrast between an alcoholic and someone who's not alcoholic, you know, but can quit drinking on their own. I thank God for that, because when, you know, the hamster wheel starts turning and I can do it, you know, I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I don't know if I'm alcoholic. I don't know. You know, certainly I did that a lot when I first got sober. Now when I start doing that, I know I need to go to a meeting. I need to call my sponsor. I know I need to do something for somebody else. One of the things that I used to look out my window, and I would look at all the happy people going on with their lives and, like, you know, just thinking they've got something. I didn't get it. You know, I don't know. There's something I'm missing. The common thing that I've seen even today is, you know, people that are happy in Alcoholics Anonymous, people that are happy out in the real world, the one thing is that they're always doing for others. They're always doing something for somebody else. And, you know, I would do something for somebody else, but I was getting paid to do it. I was getting some kind of kickback. I really didn't do for others unless there was some benefit to me. When we lived in the town, you know, in Scottsville, there were people that, because we lived really close to the office, some people on the weekends would come to my house. Like, you know, they've got, like, I cut my arm with a chainsaw. Can you sew me up? You know, and that happened actually a fair amount. But I got to the point where I hated that. It just really used to irritate me so much. And I got to the point where, you know, instead of an attitude of being helpful, and I don't mean, like, helpful in general, but sometimes having a bad day, I never wanted to help anybody. That happened all the time. And, you know, no wonder. I mean, no wonder. I didn't. You know, I was miserable inside. So I can't have any kind of light in life because I'm rotting away inside. I got to the point where I just thought, you know, this is an awful life, and I'm just thinking it's just too much work. Life shouldn't be this hard. There's just a lot of work in this life. And so I would think about ways that maybe, you know, people really don't know me. They don't know me. One day you're going to be surprised. So I would, you know, have these great ideas. Maybe I'll just, you know, drive my car into a tree. I'll drive my car into the bridge. I'll do all the, you know, just some kind of thing. And it's going to shock people. And it'll be a way that they can really find out who I am. And the truth is, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know anything about me. I knew nothing about me at all. So I've told you about 2007. I've told you about all the breaking of bones. I continued to drink for 3 more years. I continued to drink for 3 more years, even after that fairly significant consequence. And it was awful. It was an awful time. You know, people say alcoholism stopped, or alcohol stopped working for me. And there would be the occasional, you know, like really random and great time. And there was one time in particular that I can tell you that was so great that I thought, I've got this thing down now. I've got this down. It was one, we went to this birthday party for someone, and it was quite lovely and quite, you know, ritzy. And again, you know, dressing it up. And I woke up drunk. I mean, I did that a lot, but I woke up drunk in this one particular time, and I told my husband, and I said, "Dear God, I'm really getting this thing down. I'm getting good at this. You know, I don't feel sick at all. I don't feel hungover. I drank, let's see, champagne, white wine, Patron. I feel great. I got this." This was 7:30 in the morning. He said, "You're still drunk. Go back to bed." And the truth is, you know, that's a minute little thing, but he was exactly right. So by 11 o'clock, I was, you know, dog wagging, you know, just, it was awful. It was awful. That started happening a lot, and I started realizing, you know, I don't have this. I don't have this. So I better start, you know, I'm starting to feel on fire. I started going to a psychologist, and because I thought my problem was my childhood, and I thought my problem was, you know, people just aren't, it's just, you know, what about me? I need some me time. So I started going to a psychologist, and I was able to rant and rave about myself for about 50 minutes. And that was great because, you know, she would just basically nod her head. And the only thing I ever heard from her that had anything to do with drinking was, you know, there are some people that shouldn't drink, and you're probably one of them. And that was it. That was it. And the thing is, I was never honest with her about my drinking. I was never forthcoming about any of my part in anything. Then I decided, you know, gosh, you know, psychiatry is ridiculous. All the psychology, I'll just do this on my own. So, you know, my bookshelf is filled with, like a lot of us, you know, about 200 self-help books. And I decided I just need to live my best life. And so I lived my best life for about, I don't know, 9 months or so. And that was the time that I switched to drinking champagne only. And it's exactly like our book says. And our book talks about this beautifully. And so I drank champagne morning, noon, and night. I'm still working. I'm still working. I'm still reeking, and I'm still working. And I'm bloated. And so I start taking fluid pills. And so I started taking fluid pills because, you know, I can write scripts. I can call scripts in. So I started doing all that. So I'm drinking, you know, a lot of booze, not eating a lot, blowing up. And taking my fluid pills. So I'm managing, doing good. Then my best life wasn't so good. And so I thought, you know, I just need to be mindful. And I need to just really, I need to participate in something mindful. And so I went to Jon Kabat-Zinn, Mindfulness for Medical People. And I don't know about you guys, but sitting for 8 hours in a room a little bit bigger than this, in silence, and eating, you know, we had to eat, like, all this really mindful food, and it was excruciating because I couldn't drink for 8 hours. My wheels were turning. The people, you know, just like my entourage was going, "God, I can't believe it. You're just a nut." It was excruciating, and I thought, this is not great. I'm not loving mindfulness. I thought, you know what? White space is not for me. I'm still drinking. I'm still doing everything I can do. My life has fallen apart, but white space is not for me. But that's my problem. I've got too much white space. So I just started to overcommit and, you know, just throw myself into anything I could throw myself into. So I became a very overcommitted no time on my hands, extremely lonely person. And that's what I did. I participated in all these things, but I never felt part of. I felt like a nut. I wanted to get out of there so I could go drink. And I couldn't figure out why people weren't just, you know, bending over backwards, because I volunteered for this. What is wrong? That lasted some time. Then I decided, you know what, I just need a life coach. And so I went, and the life coach said, look, you're fine. You've done all these things. Everything's great. What you need is a cause. And so I thought, yeah, that's it. That's it. I need a cause. And so what I did was I picked a cause, and I decided to continue to drink just like I've been drinking. But I started measuring out my drink. So I got this little really cute measuring cup because I knew that you could only have a certain amount of ounces. You know, and for women, it's amount. So I started measuring my woman's amount of alcohol and would drink that and then pour that in and then drink that and pour that in. And then my cause was buying nothing made in China. So the last year of my life, I'm drinking like crazy, but I'm not buying anything made in China because that's my cause. And you know what? I was miserable. I was miserable. I was nuts. I was a bad. I was a bad example of a human being. And never did I think of the fact that, you know, God, I really need to look at my alcoholism, because I didn't know I had alcoholism. My last drink was nothing special, but it was the same kind of thing. You know, started out with dinner, drinking during making dinner, gonna drink for dinner, but I decide I don't want to do this. Let's go downtown. So all the dinner I cooked, you know, went by the wayside. We went downtown, drank. But a weird little thing happened. You know, it was definitely, you know, my moment of clarity. A guy stepped on my toe. It's the strangest little thing, but for me, honestly, you know, the devil is in the details of my daily life, and it, you know, just how nothing special about my story, but. It was the same thing with this moment of clarity. A guy stepped on my toe, and it was the weirdest little pain, because as drunk as I was, and I can remember being that drunk, it reminded me. It was like this weird, like, flashback to the broken, all those broken bones I had. And I just knew. I was like, something, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. And I went home, and the same kind of thing, and I threw up all over, threw up all over this white chair we had. Why would you have white in your house when you were an alcoholic? I don't know. But threw up all over the white chair. And I remember turning over and telling my husband, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know where that came from. I have no idea where that came from. That was on a Thursday. I didn't get to a meeting until Monday. But the thing is, I was so sick. And this is another God thing, and I know it is. I was so sick. I was physically so ill for 14 days. I detoxed myself because I had all these drugs at home. And I was able to detox myself and basically lay in bed and pop pills for, you know, 3 days. Well, I went to that meeting that night. It was amazing because, first off, I thought I was in a Sunday school meeting because, you know, it's in the basement of a church. There are all these boys in there. I'm like, why are these boys? And they all got on matching uniforms. But there was a guy who was leading the meeting, and I was like 2 minutes late, and he just did this to me. I came in the back room, and he goes, I just remember thinking, well, that's nice. And I saw this woman sitting down in the front row, and she, it was the weirdest thing. Like, she was really listening intently to what was being said, and she looked so, like she had this kind of okayness about her. And I was like, wait, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but they are not falling apart. No one's falling apart and crawling out of their skin. Wow, okay, I heard the speaker. The speaker went on to describe his drinking. He talked about the solutions in the big book. He talked about his alcoholism. He talked about the doctor's opinion. He, self-centered I was, I knew, because he talked about exactly stuff that had happened to me. I really thought that my husband had gotten on the phone, found out where I was going, and talked to the guy and found out and said, now this is what she's been doing, and I want you to, that's where my mind was, because it's always about me all the time. The guy was from Richmond. He didn't know who the heck I was, and, you know, none of that was true. I got a sponsor my second meeting. She gave me her name and her number, and she said, give me a call. And the next day I called her. You know what? I didn't know a lot about this program, but I knew that I didn't want the life that I had had. I didn't want that life anymore. And you guys were sitting there, like, looking really okay just to be sitting there listening. You were looking okay, like you had some kind of thing. You had something that I wanted. I didn't know what it was. I asked her to be my sponsor, and she and I got to work immediately. We got right into the steps. And you know what? I am so happy. I hadn't read ahead. I didn't know anything about any steps. I kind of knew, like, well, you need a 12-step program. I didn't really know what that ever meant. But we got busy right away. And honestly, it was the best thing. It was the best thing for me. One of the things I learned is that I had plenty. You know, I didn't have to start and keep apologizing for, I'm sorry, I've never been arrested. I'm sorry, I didn't, you know, honestly, that the first few meetings I went to, I was like, oh, I don't have that. And then that didn't happen to me, but, you know, but I kept hearing the message. I heard the message enough to know that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you come in here with. It doesn't matter, you know, what kind of trauma and drama you've had. It just matters what, you know, what's in here, you know, what's blocking you from the solution. That's what I knew. The first three steps, honestly, you know, it had plenty of evidence that showed me my life is out of control and, you know, it's definitely unmanageable. I had plenty of reason for that. Step two, you know, I wanted something different. I didn't know anything about, I knew I was crazy, but I didn't know that there was a special name for my crazy. So it was a relief. You know, I didn't have a lot of problem with step two at all. I always knew that there, you know, was some kind of God, and I kind of had an old idea about God. I spent a lot of time in church, and I spent a lot of time being miserable, thinking, God, I got to pray for these people. Oh. You know, I had a perverse idea about what God was, but I didn't know that. In step three, you know, I just knew I wanted to go on with the rest of the steps. I knew I wanted something different. And I was willing to do it. I was willing to do anything I could do to get a better life. Honestly, at that point in time, I just wanted relief. Steps four and five, we did exactly, and it was exactly like the book describes. You know, it's where, I mean, having a sponsor, you know, I mean, it's the thing. Your sponsor is so, it's so right there for you. Because I didn't know, I was all excited because I was getting to write my mess down. I was getting to air my grievances. And I was excited about that because, again, I hadn't read ahead. So I didn't know that, you know, oh, I got to look at my side. I got to look at my part in this. I didn't know any of that. So I'm like, I'm getting fired up and sitting on that sofa and telling her my stuff. And then we talk about, okay, now we got to look at your part. What's going on here? How are you, you know, dishonest, self-centered, selfish? What? It is so true. The program describes it beautifully, which is, you know, by doing that, by just going ahead and acting as if and going through, you know, those steps, I was really able to see my part in everything that had happened. And even though I had a lot of, you know, people that had harmed me way more than I'd harmed them, I still had very much a part in, you know, the wreckage of my life. I had a big part in the wreckage of my life. Six and seven, you know, I would have told you I'm a nice person. I'm a law-abiding citizen. You know, I couldn't have told you that, you know, I was a people collector, and I couldn't have told you that I liked just things to look all shiny and new, but that was just a facade. I couldn't have told you any of that. I couldn't have told you that I used honesty as a weapon. But through the inventory, I was able to see that. I couldn't have told you that I had judgments about people just on the way that they, the things they bought. We just talked about this on the way up here. The brands of food they bought, I had judgments against people, you know. Not nice. Not nice. Not somebody I want to hang out with. I asked God to remove those and just went ahead. You know, I didn't spend a lot of time getting mired down in that. Steps 8 and 9, I had an amends list that I thought was going to be easy peasy. and for the most part it was, because I was concentrating on the candle holder that I stole from Star Hill. I was like, that's going to be easy. I can go in there and I can pay, you know, I can pay $20 and that'll be okay. Because I stole that candle holder because my friend wanted it. Star Hill closed. We're done. It was the bigger stuff. It was the big stuff like my mother-in-law, you know. It was the big stuff like my husband. It was the stuff, you know, it was the people on that list, like my mother, who, you know, I was able to blame for years because she abandoned me. You know what? The thing is, this program showed me that she did the exact best thing for me. Yeah, if I look at it on this way, she abandoned me. But the beauty is she knew she couldn't take care of me, so she left me with people who could take care of me. You know, that's the thing. That's the thing that you guys did for me, this program did for me, is you were able to help me to see that. I got teased about this a little bit, but my men's list, all the people on it, I had gotten to the point where a lot of us get to, you know, I couldn't look at my face in the mirror, and I really, that's where it was. I couldn't look at my own self. So I took all my people, and I put them on Post-it notes. And when I did an amends, I would take the note down. And so, you know, at the end, I saved the last two for last, and you know, that they were covering my eyes. And, you know, that was the last thing. And so I was able to slowly see the image, my own image in the mirror. And it was kind of a, you know, task-oriented thing for me. But I was able to do it that way. Slowly, when those amends started happening, I was able to look at my own self. And that was really, really helpful. You know, so the two that covered my eyes, I mean, those were pretty, pretty profound for me. Steps, you know, 10, it keeps us current. It keeps us current because, you know, this is an ongoing process. And thank gosh, because we're spiritual beings, you know, spiritual beings continue to give and grow. And step 10 just reminds me of that every day. Step 11, you know, it's conscious contact for me is fleeting. It's certainly not all the time. I think if it was all the time, I'd spontaneously combust. I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't. I would just be like, you know, in some kind of knot on this earth. But when I do make conscious contact with God, it's awesome, and it's usually with you guys. It's not, you know, with me setting out by myself, isolated once again. Whether it's because I've done it or something else has happened. I will tell you that just for me, to keep the noise down, the noise in my soul and in my head, I have to limit gadgets. It's not certainly that, you know, God is anti-iPad, but just for me, I have to really, you know, keep the noise out. I just know that I work better with less stuff in my life like that. You know, that really, you know, Facebook, I'm sure Facebook is great, and I'm on Facebook, but the point is, you know, all that gets in my way. It makes me not hear. It muffles stuff for me. And step 12, you know, thank gosh for step 12, because of step 12, I'm in here, and I'm able to carry this message. You know, I've had the opportunity to work with other women, and it's been wonderful. It's been great. And you really see, you know, you see this come full circle. There is a point in time where, you know, we go and we give what we get, and then that corner turns. And it's just like my drinking, you know. There was a corner that turned when I was drinking. And it was something I don't ever want to turn that corner again. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a corner that turns, and you can see where giving and working this program, it's full circle. And you do. You give and you get. It's amazing to me. I can tell you that I'm an Alcoholic Anonymous member in good standing. When I'm not, when I'm falling short, I've got a sponsor that will let me know. And I value that very much. You know, it's something that I can't speak well enough on. Today, I like I said, I have a granddaughter. She's awesome. And, you know, my life today is pretty darn amazing. And nothing on the outside has changed that much. Nothing on the outside has changed that much. The thing is, everything has changed on the inside, because I'm able to be honest with people today in a way that I never was before. And that makes for a life that I want. It makes for a life that is okay. Like, what I have is okay. And that's, you know, I can't ask for anything more than that. It's just a great life. And I owe it to you guys. All the stuff I tried, all the systems, all the management, all the life coaches and the causes, none of that ever fixed me. But Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the deal. So that's all I've got. Thank you for letting me share.